First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Florida schools no longer have to quarantine kids who test positive for COVID-19. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a look at the controversial new rule allowing parents to decide whether their kids should quarantine if they've been exposed to coronavirus. Give us a call now, 549-2937. Then later, the sounds of September. We'll listen to some local talent in our Jacksonville Music Experience DJ sessions. But first this morning, Florida's controversial new Surgeon General caused shock and dismay across the state Wednesday. He has announced through the State Department of Health that school kids who've been exposed to COVID-19 are no longer required to quarantine. That's if they're asymptomatic. Instead, under this new order, parents decide if their children attend school after being exposed to COVID. In a statement, the department said there's a need to minimize the amount of time students are removed from in-person learning and to protect the rights of parents. However, physicians and public health experts around the state are reacting negatively to this order, saying that it will endanger kids and spike COVID cases once again, just as we're reaching the point when Florida seems to be starting to turn the corner on this pandemic. This morning, we welcome Dr. Jeff Goldhagen, Professor and Chief Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at UF College of Medicine, JAX. He's also President of the International Society for Social Pediatrics and Child Health. Dr. Goldhagen, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and thank you for the opportunity.
Good to have you. And also joining the show, Rachel Carestes. She's a trained biologist, a public policy analyst, and Executive Director of Science Is Us. Rachel, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And as we talk about this new quarantine rule for Florida school children, give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Well, Dr. Goldhagen, let's begin with you. The new state Surgeon General, Joseph Ladapo, was only appointed Tuesday. He has yet to be confirmed by the Florida Senate. He signed this emergency rule the very next day. Pediatricians, epidemiologists around the state are speaking out against this. Where do you stand?
Well, Melissa, this is just a profound escalation of the conflict between science and politics, and it's being played out in our schools, and children, unfortunately, are the victims. Some will be infected. There will be increased numbers of kids that will be infected. Some will get sick, and some will be hospitalized, and unfortunately, some will die. And this is a political decision, not a decision that's based on medicine, science, or public health.
What's your reaction to the argument from Dr. Ladapo that keeping kids quarantined, if they're asymptomatic, is detrimental to their in-person learning?
Well, that's like comparing apples and oranges. So we know very definitively that this Delta variant is highly transmissible, that in particular in an environment in which there are no masks, since there's a mask ban in the state, that means every child that's exposed to another child in a classroom will have a high chance, a very significant chance of being infected. Upwards of 50% of children who are infected with and transmitting the virus are asymptomatic. So children in the classroom won't know who's actually infected. And the irony is that this will result in more children infected, more classrooms closed, more schools closed, more children sick, and more children hospitalized. The flip side of this is that we do know how to protect children, and there are many school districts around the country that are implementing really very aggressive strategies that include wearing masks, that include social distancing, cohorting children, and testing every week, once or twice a week, to identify which kids are infected, and making sure that, in fact, those kids who are exposed to them are quarantined. So we know how to stop this. These are political decisions that are jeopardizing the health and well-being of our children. Parents should be infuriated. We all as a community should be infuriated by this political decision.
We'll go to your calls in a moment. The number to join us, 549-2937. Rachel Corestes, you're a scientist, executive director of the public policy organization Science Is Us. What is the evidence-based advice for quarantining after exposure, and what's your reaction to this?
Well, I mean, as Dr. just said, we know exactly what we're supposed to do here. When you're exposed to COVID-19, the scientific and medically approved answer is to remove yourself from other people, right? To go into quarantine until, a period of time has passed that you're not symptomatic or that you've been tested and that test is negative. This is actually something we've known from the beginning of the pandemic, and it's not unique to COVID. I think it's important to point out that this same sort of process of when you've been exposed to someone with a contagious disease, which COVID-19 is, you quarantine. You quarantine, stay away from other folks if you are sick, or you get tested. And if your test comes back negative, then you can resume normal activities. So what we're asking folks to do here with respect to COVID-19 is actually not any different than what we would expect from anyone, adults or children in school, when exposed to any very contagious and serious disease.
You know, Rachel, I believe you have school-age children in Florida. We still, in my household, we have one in the Duval County Public Schools. And several times since school began in August, I've received a robocall from Douglas Anderson School letting me know as a parent that there was a positive COVID test somewhere on school campus and that they would let me know if my child had been exposed to this person, so that I could then be aware and quarantine my child. You have to ask, under this new directive, those calls are, at least at schools that follow the order, those calls are going to stop.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the school districts, and I have a kindergarten.
Or they might stop. Go ahead.
Those calls may stop. I think we need to see how individual school districts are going to react to that. I know, looking this morning sort of frantically to see what the local schools are going to do, no one has really said they're trying to figure out what they're going to do in response. But, as a parent of a child that is not old enough yet to be vaccinated, it feels incredibly vulnerable. You're sending your child to school. You don't know if they're going to be in an environment necessarily where everybody's going to be wearing masks. And there's nothing really you can do to protect them, especially if you pull away this barrier of being able to at least have some confidence that if they're going to be exposed to someone with COVID-19 that you would know, but also that someone who potentially has COVID-19 is not coming back to the classroom the next day. I think it's something that's very worrying. I wear two hats, obviously, as a scientist, but also as a parent of a young child. And it's a roller coaster week for us, right? If you're a parent of a young child, because we started the week off thinking, oh, my goodness, there's going to be a vaccine soon. There's hope in sight. And now to make a change like this, it's very disappointing.
It's 549-2937. We are being inundated with tweets. Dr. Goldhagen, I think the question many have is, will school districts, at least some of them, defy the governor the way they have when it comes to implementing mask mandates for children? Here's a tweet from Susan. I've heard that the Duval County schools will continue to follow the policy they put in place on September 7th. The school board should join other counties in challenging this new rule. Dr. Goldhagen.
Well, I think the school systems that defied the mask ban are the ones that will have shown the courage and following the evidence base to defy this. But Melissa, I would challenge you a bit and challenge parents a bit on depending on school systems around the state, including Duval County, to rely on information from them that their child had been exposed to a particular child in a classroom, because the contact tracing that was required in order to do that by our health department is not necessarily there. And as we've spoken in the past, public health in this state and in this public health in this community has been dismantled, not because there are not wonderful, committed individuals, professionals, but because, again, as policy, policy across the state, public health has been dismantled. I think parents are, you know, as there are other guests that said, parents are in a very difficult situation. Personally, my recommendation to parents now that the vaccine is on the horizon, given this new policy, if your school system is going to follow this policy, I would keep my child out of school until they get fully vaccinated and rely on virtual school, it's available.
If it's available. 549-2937. Here's a tweet from Agatha. My kids came down with COVID-like symptoms a few weeks ago, and we kept them home. We tested after a few days, but I was able to send them back without showing a negative COVID test. So much of this already relies on parents who choose to do the right thing. Rachel, a lot of this is on the parents, the honor system of parents communicating with the school, working together, and putting the good of the entire student body first.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a big responsibility on us as parents all the time when we're sending our kids to school. I mean, even when it's not COVID, right? You don't want to send your child to school if they are sick, just in general, full stop. But this, I think that given the state of the pandemic, you asked me about the public policy implications of all of this. We need public policies that don't just leave this up to parents trying to do the right thing. Because parents have a lot to deal with. There's a lot of questions. There's a lot of information. We need public policies that are actually in place, that follow the evidence, that are consistent with the science, and that make things easier for parents to do the right thing.
549-2937. Let's go to your calls now, parents. Lynn in Palatka. Hi, Lynn.
Yeah. Hey, both of my sons have gone home from school with minor ailments, you know, muscle aches or whatever. They immediately put them on 10 days, you know, quarantine. Unless I can produce a COVID test. In Putnam County, they only test on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Mm.
So I have to go buy a test, get them tested to get them back in school. Had I not done that, they would have missed a week of school.
Wow, yeah. That, Lynn,
so it is
that,
really hard.
Yeah.
Either way, I mean, I don't want my kid. One is vaccinated, one is too young. But they don't tell us anything at all about who might be sick, when or where. I mean,
wow.
It's just really hard to get information.
And Lynn, you know, you bring up such a great point, too, that you had to go pay for the tests yourself to get your children back in a timely manner. So, Lynn, I'm sorry about that, and I appreciate that call so much. Dr. Goldhagen, this gets back to what you were saying earlier, which is that some school districts around the country are testing kids regularly. Why can't we do that here?
Well, that's the answer to that question is very simple. We can do that here. We could implement comprehensive strategies to diminish significantly the spread of COVID in our school system. Those strategies have been implemented other places around the country. They've been really very successful. They're relatively simple. They're less expensive than, in fact, dealing with the issues that we're dealing with. We need to implement them immediately. We need to re-implement a public health system that works, and we need to stop using children as political pawns for political aspirations of others. And those strategies I just mentioned, masking, social distancing, disinfecting, cohorting children, and finally, testing them once or twice a week to make sure that we identify who's infected, and then rigorous contact tracing to let parents know if their children have been exposed to other kids that are infected.
Here's a tweet from a listener. The honor system also doesn't take into account the pressures parents are under. What if they don't have jobs that allow them to stay home with sick kids? She says, 549-2937. Cheryl on the West Side. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I would just like to echo that I am just appalled at this use of children as a political pawn by our governor, Death Santis, and his party of death. I just can't understand why he expects us to sacrifice our future. These children do not have the luxury of having a vaccination, and all the measures that your previous guest just spoke about, that's all we can do to protect our children. I have three in the public school system, and I'm just appalled that Governor DeSantis would expect us to consider them disposable, I guess because they can't vote and they can't donate.
Cheryl, thanks for the call. And I understand this is hugely controversial. Certainly the public polling shows that a majority of Floridians approve of mask mandates in schools, the kind of measures Dr. Goldhagen just talked about. That said, I want to get your reaction, Rachel, to this move by the DeSantis administration, which is admittedly aimed at a minority of the state's voters, but they do feel very strongly about this. The governor and his new surgeon general are arguing that parents should be able to make choices for their kids and that students need to be in school. What's your reaction to that argument that speaks to, as I said, it's a minority of Floridians, but they feel very strongly about it?
Right. So the first thing I would say is with respect to who supports these actions or not, if you don't support these actions, you have a responsibility to also speak out. You can call the governor, you can call your state legislators. People won't know that you oppose them if you don't tell them. So that's the first thing. The second thing, though, is the argument here that is being made is not a scientific argument, right? It's not, we know what the science, we know what the medicine is, we know what we need to do. It's a different sort of public policy argument, sort of doing this cost-benefit analysis where they're suggesting that making sure that as many kids are in classrooms as much as possible is a benefit that outweighs the cost of allowing the pandemic to spread. And so that's where I think we need to analyze this. I'm actually in Washington, D.C. this week, and on the National Mall here is this huge installation of flags, one that represents every person that has died from COVID-19 in the United States. It's over 670,000. You can't stand on the edge of this and not see that loss and think about that cost and think about the folks that have been sick, that have been hospitalized. As was mentioned, you know, more children will get sick here. We may just be turning the curve in Florida on this pandemic. The cost and the benefit ratio here certainly is on the side of following the science and medical evidence, because the cost of doing those things is low, right? Vaccinations are free, they're easily accessible, they're relatively painless. Wearing a mask doesn't hurt, maybe a little bit uncomfortable, but it's not something that places a big burden on you. The social distancing, the disinfecting, washing your hands, these are not things that are really hard to do. They don't cost a lot, they don't have a lot of pain associated with them. And the benefit of that, ultimately, if you want to keep kids in school, is to slow the pandemic. And those are the things that will do it. So if you want to keep kids in the classroom, you got to look at the things that are actually going to do it and ask, is this place too much of a burden on folks? Well, no, the answer is that. And with respect to parents' rights, I mean, this notion that I have a right to infect anyone that I want is kind of antithetical to how we view freedom and liberty in the United States. We typically take this position that your rights extend as far as infringing mine. So your right to infect me stops at my right not to be infected. And I think that that's an important way to reframe this conversation. Where is my right or the right of my child to maintain health
and well-being. I think that's an important flip on the whole narrative around parents' rights.
Let's go to Jennifer in Putnam County. Hi, Jennifer. Are you a teacher?
I am a teacher. I took a one-year leave of absence to help out my elderly parents this year, but I'm very invested in the conversation as I'll be going back into the classroom, and I have friends in the classroom. And what I want to add is, as a teacher, we adapt our environment to protect the vulnerable, so that if a child has a peanut allergy, we make sure nobody brings peanuts into the room in any form so that that kid's protected. And if a child has migraines, we adapt our lighting environment to protect our vulnerable students as a community. And I don't understand where the compassion has gone. And that's just a comment I wanted to make. And thank you for covering this.
Thank you, Jennifer. Yeah, the peanut analogy is one that we've heard a lot in recent days. Cynthia in Lakeshore. Hi, Cynthia. You're on the air. Go ahead, Cynthia. Turn your radio down and go right ahead. Go ahead,
Good
Cynthia.
Morning.
Turn your radio down.
Melissa, I just would like to make one suggestion, and that is that each of us...
Can't hear you, Cynthia.
That each of us would call our state representatives and make it so that this particular Surgeon General cannot be improved.
Cannot be approved. Thank you for that. Dr. LaDapo still faces confirmation by the Senate, the state Senate. Dr. Jeff Goldhagen, obviously that is widely expected to happen given that it's a Republican-dominated body. Dr. LaDapo is affiliated with UCLA. He is well-credentialed, although his views about how to approach the pandemic are widely condemned by the majority of public health experts. Dr. Goldhagen, do you believe that this man is a quack?
Well, Melissa, first let me say that my views are my views and not those those of the University of Florida. Well, this is very disappointing. There's a movement in medicine now amongst the boards that certify physicians to decertify physicians who transmit misinformation. And so it'll be interesting to see whether or not this unfolds with respect to Dr. LaDapo. I would certainly not call a colleague a quack, but this is all about politics and not about science and medicine. And again, with all due respect to...
Well, do you believe he's unqualified to lead this state's pandemic response, to be the state's top doctor?
I believe he has wonderful qualifications that would allow him to be a wonderful advocate for science and medicine. I would say that these decisions, this decision that he's made, indicates that it is not appropriate for him to be leading our public health system.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you both, Dr. Jeff Goldhagen, Rachel Carestes, Science is Us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Much more still ahead later. TEDx Jacksonville returns. We'll get a preview of what will be on stage this fall. But up next,
we have created a program that sort of goes opposite of what gentrification typically does in under-resourced neighborhoods.
A new home ownership program to lift up the city's east side. We'll tell you about Project Boots next. For years, millions turned to their daily local paper to help them stay connected to their community. Many papers have gotten smaller and some are gone altogether. So public radio news is growing to fill the void, and we need your help. There's strength in local journalism, and it begins with you. Give now at wjct.org/donate or call 353-9528.
NPR is 50. I'm Ari Shapiro, and as students go back to school, we wonder what our 50th reunion would be like. We would dance to great music, reminisce over old memories, and we wouldn't just celebrate with the people who were there back then, we would invite everyone to the party. So whether you've been listening since 1971 or 1 minute ago, celebrate with us. NPR, then, now, and next.
On WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new home ownership program for the city's historic East Side. Project Boots will operate in the city's most under-resourced communities and provide a path to home ownership to help residents build generational wealth and change the narrative of the neighborhood. Pedro Cohen is executive director at LISC Jacksonville Local Initiatives Support Corporation, and he told me more about Project Boots. Pedro, good to talk to you. So tell us all about Project Boots and what you hope it'll accomplish for the historic East Side.
Well, it's great to talk to you as well, Melissa. And Project Boots for me is probably one of the most innovative things that I think we've come up with in a very long time in terms of trying to bring people back to one of Jacksonville's most historic neighborhoods. And so we have created a program that sort of goes opposite of what gentrification typically does in under-resourced neighborhoods. We are literally bringing back people who are familiar with the neighborhood and have identified it as a place that they want to live, or in some cases they want to live again, having grown up in this neighborhood. So the body of people that we're putting together, we're putting them together to call Eastside their home for the foreseeable future. And we're doing it through an incentive program that will stay with us for 12 months. We'll give you close to $14,000 towards down payment and closing costs to move back into the neighborhood.
Wow, that's great, because, of course, home ownership is just increasingly out of reach for so many people. And this
right.
will make all the difference for a lot of families.
Yeah, absolutely correct. And our first target group sort of fits into that that sweet spot that we all like to call essential workers. So we have two teachers that are a part of our program, entrepreneur that's a part of our program, an architect and a doctor that's a part of our program. And for us, you know, the hardest part, particularly, people who fit into the BIPOC community, is coming up with the money needed to put a down payment on a house. And so we're closing that gap for them, but it's also a quid pro quo relationship where they have to be a part of our program for 12 months. And so we're helping them through down payment assistance and closing costs. And I'm excited about the opportunities and the prospects of what this could bring. Again, and we're doing it without literally disenfranchising any of the people that currently live in the neighborhood.
But you said in return, people have to go through a program at LISC, the Local Initiative Support Corporation. Tell us about that.
So this program, you know, when I was designing it, I looked at the program that HUD offers and you know, through their HUD counseling program. And we really wanted to look at, you know, how could we enhance that? And so in designing it, I looked at the sociology associated with living in a under-resourced neighborhood. I looked at the, you know, the ecological risk associated with living in a under-resourced neighborhood, and built a program that was enticing to the people who were there and those people who were asking to be residents. And what I mean by that, what are some of the political challenges that elected officials face when they represent districts like this? And so we've worked with local politicians to come into some of our sessions, which, by the way, are held every second Saturday for 2 hours. And so we bring in elected officials in our first session to talk about specifically what are some of the challenges that they faced as elected officials representing this district. We've brought in people to talk about specifically some of the isms that the BIPOC community faces around money, and how do we get past some of those. We will focus one session on health challenges that, you know, sometimes are specific to communities of color, and how does the built environment contribute to those health challenges. We've also included things around the challenges that schools in some of these under-resourced communities will face. So as you can see, we were very deliberate in the program creation to be reflective of some of the things that you will face when you move into a community that has been neglected for an extended period of time.
And that sure describes the East Side, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. But I think that when you are intentional around the work that you're doing, and, you know, fortunately for us, we have good partners who have been engaged with us and have given us some leeway to make it work. And I think that what we are doing and what we are creating here in Historic East Side can sort of be the blueprint and the antithesis to gentrification that we know happens in communities like this. And I think that we are onto something that could be totally transformational, not only for Jacksonville, but it could be transformational for other communities that are grappling with how do you build communities and keep people who are indigenous to those communities in place without disenfranchising them or making them feel not part of the process.
Yeah. Home ownership, you think, could be the key. Giving people that leg up to home ownership.
Right. And I think that's not only a key to it, but you have to do it in our particular case with people who are not looking to be a part of, again, removing people from the neighborhood, but who can sort of incentivize those people by profession, by choices that they've made along the way to be better people today than they were yesterday and better people tomorrow than they currently are at this moment. And so we're doing that by bringing people who understand some of the subtle social nuances that happens in these communities. And I think that's something that we don't take into consideration when gentrification happens. It, you know, you're here, but you're not good enough to be my neighbor. What we're saying to people is, you know, I was your neighbor at one point. Now I'm back to become your neighbor again. And if I can do it, ultimately you can too. And I think for us, the end result is how do we make these institutions work for people who've lived in these challenged communities? And we know that it can work and that they do work, but they have to have people who it has worked for that looks like them. And so that's what we're trying to do with Project Boots.
We'll follow it. It's Project Boots in Jacksonville's Historic East Side. Check it out at lisc.org/Jacksonville. Executive Director Pedro Cohen. We'll follow along. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa. I mean, I look forward to people and, you know, sending in their questions and, you know, answering anything we can answer for them.
Well, TEDx Jax is coming up next month at the Times Union Center, featuring both local and national speakers. The theme this year is Embrace. We've got a preview with Sabine Perwes of TEDx Jacksonville. Hey, Sabine.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also on the line, Michelle Ramos, one of the featured speakers this year. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, and good morning.
Okay, so live talks this October 23rd, Sabine, on a range of issues. The theme is Embrace. Tell us about it.
We're really excited to be back. We took a break last year, and we knew that our audience was ready to hear from our amazing speakers again. So we wanted to be careful and thoughtful and provide both options to be virtually present or in person, because we wanted to give our speakers a full production experience as well. And it'll take place October 23rd at Terry Theater, which is a new venue for us. And we're excited to be back.
Okay, and I'm looking through the list of speakers. Looks amazing. Michelle Ramos, PhD, you are one of the featured speakers on the TEDx stage. Your talk is entitled Philanthropy Must Be Decolonized. Tell us a little bit about what we'll learn.
Absolutely. So, you know, I really wanted to focus this talk on, you know, doubling down on looking at philanthropy. You know, philanthropy is a cornerstone of white supremacy, from family foundations that are founded from decades of wealth that has been built on the backs of brown and black people to corporate philanthropic arms giving, you know, we want to do good grants into communities, but without a meaningful strategy for long-term repair or even harm for the past. And so I think it's important that, you know, when we're in a time when there's a lot of money being infused into, you know, communities across the country for a variety of reasons, you know, from George Floyd to COVID to, you know, climate crisis like we've seen, you know, across the South, you know, I think we need to be asking these really hard questions, because we know in philanthropy, it's often sort of, you know, the flavor of the month. And then when this interest passed, it goes to something else. And so I really just wanted to focus on sort of the ways that philanthropy is colonized, and imagine what a world where philanthropy is decolonized looks like.
And help me out here. What would it look like? Describe,
well,
if you
know. Absolutely. I mean, just, you know, a few nuggets that I'm going to be sharing during my talk are, you know, what would it look like to have center folks who are being considered for these grants at the decision-making table? You know, we know that most often the people who are being considered for granting very often are coming from communities of color, yet the people who are around the decision-making table usually are white men. What would it look like to let the community have control of their funds, right? Like, what does it mean to actually trust the communities that you're granting funding to and allow them to have a community-controlled fund where they are, you know, the drivers of the change in their communities, and they're, you know, given the responsibility to take care of themselves? You know, so often philanthropy tries to, you know, top down and tell community what they need, or instruct community what to do with these funds. And these communities know exactly what they need, and they know exactly how to drive these funds. So, you know, what would that look like? What would it look like for philanthropy to actually give more than the average 6% that they give every year out of their endowment? You know, we talk about, like, let's liberate the endowment. You know, what would it look like if foundations and philanthropy gave 20 or 25%. So those are just a few of the things. I think also a key component is education, because quite frankly, I don't think a lot of people that are at these philanthropic tables even understand how embedded white supremacy is in their day-to-day practices.
Okay, so Sabine, here's one example of a talk you'll see at TEDx, which challenges conventional thinking, challenges existing systems. This is what all of the speakers will be touching on in one way or another, just calling for real change in a number of areas.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, if you look at all of the 8 speakers, they all highlight something we all have experienced over the past 18 months, whether that's trauma in the workplace or mental health crisis or domestic violence or, you know, learning to be advocates for our own health. I mean, these are all topics that have come up in some way, shape, or form in all of our lives due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think a lot of these individuals will share their stories, but also their real life examples on how they tackled it and what lessons they learned along the way. And I think one of the things that I'm really proud of and excited for is the number of phenomenal women that are in this lineup. You know, I always think of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of when people will say, well, if it's 9 women, why is that an issue? And this year we have 7 out of 8 are all women, and that's really fantastic.
Not only that, you've got some live music and artistic performances.
Yes.
And some interactive experiences, and you're doing all of this in the middle of a pandemic. So what are the rules?
So that's a great point, and thank you for bringing that up. We're trying to be conscious of people's capacity to sit in an auditorium with the mask. So the sessions are limited to an hour and 15 minutes. As those that have been to our conference will see that it's consolidated. We don't have the usual three sessions. We've made it a shorter day from 1 to 5 so that we're respectful of people's time and are able to do this as safely as possible. Everyone that attends in person will have to be masked inside the theater, and those virtually attending will be able to interact in the same way as the in-person audience would through our platform, Whova, and engage with one another and have activities in that platform as well, so they don't feel like they're missing something by not being present locally at the theater. We're working with Bread and Board for a great lunch experience, which is, again, outside by their breezeway, and really just trying to make sure people are able to social distance, be respectful of one another, and provide an experience for the speaker as well to see and hear from a live audience.
That's the fun of it, though, right, Michelle? Being able to speak again before a live audience.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, we're coming off of a year of isolation, frankly, where so many people have, you know, been in lockdown, have been stuck in their homes. And so, you know, just the opportunity to be, you know, in front of people and feel that energy of live audience. I'm so looking forward to that.
Sure. Okay. So with all of that said, Sabine, tickets on sale now for TEDx
Jackson.
Tickets
on sale now. Yes. Everyone can visit TEDxJacksonville.com and they can go to the click attend and learn more about the conference, each of our speakers, the day's lineup, schedule breakdown, all of the above, and there are a variety of different pricing options available from in-person to virtual, student tickets to regular attendees, and we hope to see everyone there.
Check it out, folks. TEDx Jacksonville with its new onstage lineup of speakers and musical performances for Embrace coming up Saturday, October 23rd. It's their 10th annual event. It'll be happening the afternoon of Saturday the 23rd, October 23rd, at the Times Union Center for the Performing Arts. Get your tickets now. It will be COVID safe. You will have to wear a mask. Lunch will be served outside. In addition to Michelle, a number of other great speakers like Don Emmerich talking about the mental health crisis in the workplace, Nicole Headley of Jacksonville talking about issues around Domestic Violence Awareness Month, Delaney Liskey of Virginia Beach talking about her journey with multiple sclerosis and empowering patients, and musician, keyboardist, and producer Bronero, a local artist performing live at this event. TEDxJacksonville.com or tickets at Eventbrite. Sabine Perwais, who's been heading this up for some time now, kudos to all you do, and Speaker Michelle Ramos, have fun with it. Thanks, ladies. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right, a quick break. And speaking of music, in a moment, our September music picks from the Jacksonville Music Experience as we spotlight the top local talent in town. Our music expert, Matt Shaw, steps on deck next. Don't go away. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9.
I'm Courtney Lewis, music director of the Jacksonville Symphony. The orchestra and I are delighted to welcome you for the 2021-22 season, live in Jacoby Hall, September 24th and 25th. Romance abounds as award-winning pianist Daniel Hsu performs Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20, along with the Jacksonville Symphony's inspiring musicians. Tickets at jacksymphony.org.
I'm Scott Tong. A Nashville dad says he enrolled his toddler in a COVID-19 vaccine trial after his other daughter benefited from trials of leukemia treatments.
Louise's treatment was discovered because people were willing to volunteer their children for trials.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, what leaked documents reveal about what Facebook executives knew. They knew the platform was spreading misinformation, that in some countries, Facebook was being used by human traffickers and to incite violence, and that Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, was toxic for many teenage girls. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Cities continue to ramp up their use of surveillance cameras and facial recognition systems. Fans point to the role this tech plays in fighting crime, but some are pushing back. What exactly are they watching for? And who's taking on the state's and Silicon Valley's surveillance machine? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, did you feel that slight hint of fall in the air this morning? We are celebrating September with this month's JME, Jacksonville Music Experience DJ Sessions, in which we connect you, the listener, to the beautiful noise of Northeast Florida. Arts and culture editor Matt Shaw joined me recently to share his picks for September. Matt Shaw, good to talk to you. So let's talk about September music that's flowing out of our part of Florida. You've got a lot for us to listen to.
Yeah, I feel like September, more than any other month since we started the Jacksonville Music Experience, we've just been inundated with some really great music, and our JME team kind of having a hard time keeping up with it all, but it's a good problem to have.
Especially with the return of Underbelly to downtown Jacksonville, the Sing Out Loud Festival happening now across St. Johns County. Lots of music and opportunities to listen all over town. You've got three new tracks from local artists that we're going to enjoy right now. What are we listening to?
Yeah, first up, I wanted to talk about a new project from Alyssa Leonard. It's called Souvenir. Leonard is one part of an indie rock duo called Isabella Parole. It's a well-regarded Jacksonville-based band. She sent me this new project a couple weeks ago, told me how in the midst of the pandemic it was difficult for her band to get together, so she started working on this solo project, and the results are really stunning. Snow Globe is the title of the EP she's released. It's a lush production filled with really intriguing imagery and gorgeous melodies. So I want to listen to a track from that EP called Crystal Ball. So let's listen to Crystal Ball from Souvenir.
That is gorgeous. And as you said, this is music, beautiful music that was born out of the pandemic. It was created in a challenging time.
Yeah. And if you're looking for Souvenir on Spotify, it's spelled kind of phonetically, S-O-U-V-I-N-E-E-R.
That's nice. Alyssa Leonard, pick up her EP, Snow Globe. Okay. Bronero, multi-instrumentalist, I should say. Jonah Pierre has caught your eye this month.
Yeah, Jonah is a standout pianist in the city's jazz scene. He also plays percussion in Afro-Cuban salsa band LPT, which we've played on here before. He's putting out music now under the pseudonym Brunero, and his latest is called The Life and Death of a Nation. It's kind of a funky, socially conscious track. It samples James Baldwin quotes over some 90s G-funk style synth sounds. So it's a head bobber. Let's listen to Life and Death of a Nation from Brunero.
What are you talking about? I am not a race, neither are you.
That's kind of funky and cool. And
definitely one of the most talented musicians working here locally.
Yeah, I love that. Pick it up. It's The Life and Death of a Nation by Bronero. That is cool, Matt. Okay, rounding out our trio, Persian Rugs by Sailor Goon, who will be at the Sing Out Loud Festival, right?
Yes, she's playing tonight, Friday night, as part of the Friends of Friends recording showcase at Dog Rose Brewing. It's a free show, really good lineup. We've listened to Sailor Goon on here before, but she's got a new track. She teamed up with Glenn Van Dyke and Lena Seinman, who are both Jacksonville-based multi-instrumentalists, to produce the track, and they play on it. It's got hints of R&B and jazz, even a bit of, like, psychedelia. The track's called Persian Rugs, so let's listen to Persian Rugs by Sailor Goon.
That has kind of a retro feel that I really like.
She's so great.
Yeah, that's cool. So check out Sailor Goon Friday night at Sing Out Loud. And Matt, more about all of these bands and a lot more at the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Yeah, if you want to find these songs on whatever streaming service you prefer, you can just go to jacksmusic.org. We've got write-ups about each one of these songs and links to find their music to stream.
Check it out. Stream it at jacksmusic.org and listen on our HD channels. The JME's Matt Shaw, thanks so much for the music.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
And give us a call at 353-9528 to fund the Jacksonville Music Experience and all of our news and talk. I'm Melissa Ross. Here's Bronero once again. You'll also hear him at TEDx, as we heard, next month. Keep listening, everyone, and have a great day.
No, we're talking about the life and death of this country. No, we're talking about the life and death of this country.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.